type of series of hearings, they would
probably... And again, I wanted to publicly...
Hello, this is Jerry Pippin, and welcome to our UFO show. MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, a reporting organization that's known worldwide and respected, has reached some bumps in the road occasionally, and right now they're going through a difficult time with some disenchanted members. Other members are quite happy. So what we thought we would do is spend this 2 hours on MUFON. First of all, we're going to bring on James Carrion, the former international director, who has become disenchanted and insinuated that perhaps a mole is in the boardroom. After that, we're going to spotlight the STAR Team concept. This is a fast-track investigations unit. And we have Chase Klotsky with us, who's head of that. And she will tell us how it works within MUFON, and also give us some examples of some of the cases they have been investigating. Then finally, a year ago today, or this week at least, Clifford Cliff came on our air and talked to us about his new job, and that was International Director of MUFON, replacing James Carrion. So we thought we'd bring up that interview and play part of it before we get the end of the show. It's an interesting interview in that Clifford explains many things about MUFON and especially about his own life and why he's interested in UFOs. Okay, let's get the show underway. First of all, let's start with James Carrion, then we will end up with Clifford Cliff. James Carrion is a former international director of MUFON. And he is no longer associated with the organization at all. So I guess it needs to be stated up front that James Carrion and this interview should not be construed in any way that James is officially talking for MUFON or any element of it. Anyway, James, we appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you, Jerry, for having me.
James, you've been making some pretty incredible charges and statements on your blog, and we have a link to that on our page. And we've been linking to almost every new posting you make simply because it's newsworthy. Here at the top of the show is simply to ask you, as a former international director of MUFON, involved with MUFON for several years, What do you think's happening at MUFON, and what do you want to happen?
Well, honestly, Jerry, what I think is happening to MUFON is very unfortunate. Here we have an organization that's been around 40 years, and it's had its ups and downs. But I think the thing that worries me the most about the current organization and its current leadership is the lack of what I would call a moral and ethical compass. When you have an organization like MUFON, which is a nonprofit organization, its duty is to the public, and strictly to the public. In fact, that's how it gets its certification from the IRS, because it offers a public service, and therefore is considered nonprofit and it's not taxed. Fortunately, what I've seen over the last couple of years is that outside interests have come in, and the leadership has steered MUFON's course away from its mission, which is the scientific investigation of UFOs, for the benefit of humanity and to educate the public. Again, we're talking about the public as the primary customer for MUFON. And they've let themselves be influenced and also being controlled by outside forces, namely the Bigelow Aerospace Advance Space Studies Company. I want to talk a little bit about MUFON's relationship here with BAS, because I was one of the original, the designer of the BAS project and its relationship with MUFON, what we call the STAR Teen Impact Project, or SIP. And I attended all the meetings, general meetings, with BAS representatives. And it was I who negotiated pretty much single-handedly this contract, which is actually I should say single-handedly, was a contract that was given to MUFON by Bass. And we gave it to an attorney for modification, and before it was signed. But what I want to get to into this relationship is that this was supposed to be a straightforward purchase agreement where Bass was purchasing services from MUFON, and MUFON would provide those services for a fixed price. I think you've probably seen this, a copy of the contract that's floating around the Internet.
Yes, I have.
And it basically states, if it's an original contract, I'm not sure, that it is a straightforward purchase agreement for a fixed price per month.
And what are they purchasing, James?
Well, they were purchasing MUFON's investigative services as well as access to MUFON's files, both historical files as well as the ongoing current sighting files. So what we have here is MUFON being subcontracted by a for-profit corporation, which is not unheard of in the nonprofit world, as long as you can legally cover yourself, which MUFON did in two ways. First, by signing a legal contract that stated very specifically the duties it was going to perform for Bass, and secondly, by making sure that any witness data that was provided to Bass from MUFON files was to be kept confidential by Bass, and also the witnesses allowed their data to be released to a third party. So MUFON did cover itself legally from those aspects.
Let me interrupt you for a minute. I got to know, who started this negotiation? Did they come to you, or did MUFON go to them?
Well, it was very interesting how that came about. It turns out that Bigelow approached John Schuessler, one of our board members, and I'm not sure if John was doing some separate consulting work for Bass or not, but the idea came around that MUFON was available for doing services or for doing work for Bigelow if he needed those services. And actually, the way it started was Bigelow contracted MUFON to do some specific studies that he was interested in, and after that small contract was finished, then in January of 2009, he asked MUFON representatives to come to Vegas so they could discuss a bigger contract, which was the one that resulted in the MUFON-Bass relationship. So I'm not sure who approached who, but I know that it was a personal discussion between Robert Bigelow and John Schuessler that initiated the venture.
And were you already the international director, I mean, at that time?
I was. I was international director from 2006 to 2009. And I was one of the representatives that went to Vegas, along with board member Jan Harzan and John Schuessler. And we sat down with Bass representatives, and we ironed out what we thought would be a working relationship. Then I spent the better part of a month after that just going over the contract, the proposed contract, with an attorney, as well as trying to negotiate MUFON's position. This is where I had this one-on-one discussion with Mr. Bigelow that I talked about on my blog, where I specifically was worried about the amounts that were being sent to MUFON each month. And I said, okay, well, at the end of the month, what happens to these monies that are left over that we haven't spent on project expenses? And he said in unequivocal terms, what's MUFON's money? It's a purchase agreement. So it's MUFON's money.
I have multiple sources saying that 5 months after the contract was there, he wanted to cut the amount in half and later even whittle it down further.
Well, there were two renewal periods that were built into the contract. One was June of 2009, one was October of 2009. And the contract, I mean, it basically stated there was one of three possibilities. They could either cut the funding right there, terminate the contract. They could increase the funding, or they could keep the funding at the same level. Well, rather than elect one of the three predetermined choices, when the contract renewal period came around, Mr. Bigelow said, well, you guys are banking too much money, so we want to cut your payments in half. Now, of course, at that point, I as the international director, could have made a call and said, I'm simply going to terminate this contract. It doesn't make sense for MUFON to move forward. But I deferred to the MUFON Board of Directors. It was discussed at the MUFON Board of Directors. And they basically stated, well, we're going to keep this relationship going at any price. So whether I had resigned from the position of international director then or later didn't really matter. The MUFON board of directors was dead set on maintaining their relationship with Bass, regardless of the terms. So in other words, they caved into Mr. Bigelow's demands because they saw it as a long-term funding source, and they really did not want to terminate the funding source prematurely if they could help it.
Was this the flashpoint for you? Was it the cause of your resignation?
No, actually, it wasn't at all. Again, I deferred to the board's decision on renewing the contract at a reduced amount, which they did. They cut the funding in half. When October rolled around of the same year, which was the second funding period, we had another problem because then the proposal was to cut it even further, so to further reduce the monthly amount. And at that time, also, Bass expressed an interest in knowing what MUFON was going to do with any monies that were currently in the bank account and why we weren't spending those on Bass activities. So they were basically telling us how to spend the money, even though they had no right to do so. It was a straightforward contract with a monthly contract amount, but at that point, it already had no legally binding effect because the MUFON board of directors did not stick to the original contract terms, and they should have terminated the contract back in June. So when October rolled around, at that point, we were trying to renegotiate and say, okay, well, at least keep the funding level at the same level rather than cut it again. But they said, well, we want a plan for how you're going to spend it, and we're not going to send you any checks until we do so. So basically, they stopped sending MUFON any monies at all in October. But the project was still ongoing, so there were expenses to be kept and those or to be paid, and those expenses were paid out of what MUFON had accumulated in the bank. What actually precipitated my resignation was when the contract was up for renewal in January of 2010, and the MUFON board of directors, this was something initiated by Clifford Cliff, international director, Jen Harz, and board member, they decided to enter into secret negotiations with Bass on renewing the contract without notifying me of that. I was still acting director. And the reason they did was because they were trying to scapegoat me and to blame me for why the MUFON-Bass relationship was going sour. When I found out they were in secret communication, I immediately resigned from the MUFON board and from the international director position.
James, I've talked to several state directors and people who were investigating that basically got their feathers ruffled because Bass didn't tell them anything. In fact, nobody told them that they were even there investigating. I mean, wasn't this a bone of contention? Didn't it cause a lot of problems for MUFON and for you?
Well, I think there was some hesitation on the part of some states to have MUFON investigators from outside their state going to investigate. That was the protocol. If a state had a significant event, we would attempt to use investigators in that state to immediately deploy. But if they were not available, then we would bring in MUFON investigators from outside the state. I think probably where feathers got ruffled was more when Bass personnel showed up before MUFON, right, where the witness was contacted. And that brings up another issue, which is how Bass would get notified of cases. If you go to MUFON's website right now and you click on Report a UFO, it comes up a short form. At the bottom of that short form is an election notice for the witness to say, I'm releasing my data to third parties. Well, once they check that, that case would be immediately available to a Bass investigator who could see it from their computer. So they had immediate notification of the witness, and therefore they could contact the witness first, and often they did, which ruffled the feathers of local MUFON people. And I think that was something we could foresee, and we knew that would be an issue, and it was, but not to any great extent. My concern is that even though the Bass contract is allegedly terminated and over with, and there's no relationship between MUFON and Bass, that third-party notice is still there. So is data still being released to Bass? And I'm not sure that MUFON headquarters adequately answered.
Well, as you know, when Clifford Cliff was on with me, I did ask him that question. And he said, he said that Robert Bigelow was no longer connected in any way with MUFON.
Sure, but keep in mind that Clifford Cliff was also the one who entered into secret communication with Bass while I was still acting director, so I'm not sure I necessarily trust that. Let's be honest here, Jerry. This is not a personal issue of personal revenge against Mr. Robert Bigelow or against Clifford Cliff or anybody for that matter. This is about what's right and what's wrong. This is about an organization that has a reputation to maintain. And unfortunately, the direction that this board is taking MUFON is into uncharted, unethical waters, and they're sinking the organization. And it needs to be corrected if MUFON is going to retain any semblance of respectability, and for it to stay outside the rumor mill of government involvement in conspiracy. And the only way to do that is to have complete transparency and openness, which the international director, Clifford Cliff, has preached in the past, but he has yet to embrace. There are many unanswered questions that I have about how MUFON is currently operating, and there are just as many questions that regular MUFON members have. Those questions have to be answered. You can't do that by getting on a show and skirting around the issue and playing the politician. You have to answer directly and unequivocally when you're asked these types of questions. And basically, I think that unless that happens, MUFON will always have this tainted reputation of being the black hole of ufology and even being infiltrated by outside forces.
So, James, let's be clear here. You are saying that there is some government intervention on the board at MUFON.
I absolutely and unequivocally believe and know that there is government intervention.
Well, what can you tell me about that?
Well, I can tell. I mentioned it in my blog article. There is somebody on the MUFON board who is a leaker, who's been leaking information that only the board members should.
Well, there is a leak someplace, James. I mean, that contract, the one with Bigelow, it's fairly accurate. It came from somewhere. Somebody leaked it. Somebody in the know. Somebody with that contract in hand.
Well, the only ones who should have had a copy of that contract were those who signed the non-disclosure agreement with Bass, which would be MUFON board members plus a couple of additional MUFON.
So
members.
You unequivocally believe that there's a government agent, a black op, a mole at MUFON.
Now, before we could even fly out to Vegas and talk with Bass, everyone had to sign a non-disclosure agreement. I'm not sure who leaked the contract, but I can tell you that emails that were only intended for MUFON, for the board members themselves, were leaked. I know because it's kind of funny the way this happened. Once I resigned from the board, all communication from the board to me ceased. Until at one point I had sent the board an email regarding a legal matter. And what happened was one of the board members did a reply all to the email. And so the response came to me and he thought he was only sending it to the other board members. Well, then pretty soon everybody was doing reply alls, and I'm getting everybody's responses going back and forth. And this is where I found out that I was being accused of hijacking computers when we're simply doing a standard reply all to emails, and I was getting a copy of their response. When I replied back, I put a specific title on my subject line and then found out that this was leaked to a third party. So I know specifically that my email went from the board out to a third party through a leak. So there is a leaker on the board.
Now, the MUFON board, they're all over the place, right? I mean, they're just not people who live in Colorado.
Absolutely. They're scattered around the U.S. There's a board member of California. There's a couple in Texas, which was, you know, on your show when you asked Clifford Cliff, does anyone have a security clearance at headquarters? Well, his response was accurate because the board members don't reside at headquarters. They're scattered around the U.S., so which is why I still have the open question whether or not John Schuessler was granted a security clearance as part of his relationship with us.
Well, next time I'll be a little more focused. I'm sorry I missed that. Why is it important about Schuessler and his security clearance? I mean, how could Bass or somebody in his company, Bigelow in his company, How could they and why would they be able to get him a security clearance?
That's a good question. I don't know. What influence does Bass have, or why would John Schuessler, as part of his work with Bass, require a security clearance? That's the question.
It's no secret that for a long time now, a lot of people have been mumbling behind MUFON's back that they're secret agented up. In other words, they have influences from the U.S. government, from different alphabet agencies. In fact, I've asked you yourself, on the air and off the record as well, if you are an agent of some sort. Now, I know you were in the Army Security Agency. Weren't you an interpreter, a Russian language person?
A long time ago. Yeah, 1983 to 1987, I did a four-year stint in the Army as an intelligence analyst, Russian linguist. So basically, I sat in a listening post listening to the Russians.
I mean, it's no secret. We've talked about that on the air. There's an interview on this website, jerrypepin.com, in which you talk about
that. Sure, absolutely. And the bottom line is that within ufology, you're going to find people from all walks of life. There are many people that are in UFO circles that have prior military backgrounds, prior government work, that have had security clearances in their life. That doesn't necessarily make them a government agent. If you were to get on my blog and read about the article I wrote about Men in Black and how it's just basically par for the course that if you're going to reach the upper echelons of ufology, you're going to be labeled a government agent, regardless if you are or not. If you Google 100 Men in Black on the Internet, you'll find that every international director at MUFON was labeled a man in black. The bottom line is, you know, you'll know them by their fruit. I'm a truth seeker. I've always sought after the truth. I have been as ethical as I possibly can be. And I can't see anyone out there who wants to believe me an agent, if they look at my work and see what I've really been doing, really seeing me as a disinformation agent or any agent of that sort. My concern is simply for the truth.
Maybe you can help me clear something up. I'm just not clear on it yet. What you're after, James? I read your blogs, and I get the feeling you want a good MUFON.
Well, as I said earlier in the show here, Jerry, there is a good MUFON. The problem is there's bad leadership, and these leaders who believe that third party interests, when they allow third party interests in. It's interesting to note that when MUFON and Bass established their relationship, Bass specifically stated they didn't want to be portrayed or seen as managing MUFON, when in the end, that's exactly what they did. They managed the contract, they managed the purse strings, and they influenced and manipulated the MUFON board into getting what they wanted. So outside forces have managed MUFON, and my concern is that they're still actively managing MUFON. MUFON should be an organization. It should be above reproach. It should have the highest level of ethics and morals. It should be working on behalf of the public, not behalf of a third-party for-profit corporation. And so my interest is getting MUFON back on the right track. It's not about the organization. It's not about pinning it down. It's not even about terminating this MUFON board and replacing it. I think that there are probably some good people still left on the board. But it is about righting the ship and getting things back.
So how does one get on the MUFON board?
How do you get on the MUFON board? Well, you have to
elect. You mean when there's a vacancy, the membership votes on it, or what?
No, the membership doesn't elect. It's done by the MUFON board itself.
So the current board members just pick somebody? Is that the way it works?
When I got on the board, there was a vacancy, and I happened to be working closely at MUFON headquarters on a project called the Pandora Project. And so I was asked to join the board, which I did, and was elected in. And that's how I got on. And if there was a vacancy, or if there is a future vacancy, it's basically the MUFON board members themselves recommend a replacement, and then there's an election process done by the board itself.
How would you like to see the board ran? I mean, the whole organization. Is it okay with you that the board chooses the other board members and the membership has nothing to do with it? Or would you change
it? Well, it's a good question because it's a nonprofit organization, so it's not even directly beholden to its own membership. The clientele of MUFON is the general public. So it's not really a democratically run organization, nor is it required to be. Should the membership have a say in MUFON leadership? It's a possibility. I mean, I don't see why not, especially if the board is going to continue to elect those who follow its standard line. And this board definitely needs to have its line.
Asking any group to correct themselves might be a little difficult. I mean, what are you after, James? You want them all to resign?
No, not at all. I think what needs to happen here is that the board needs to draft a statement of ethics, and also that it needs to make a public statement about how it's going to deal with outside influence and with third parties and who it owes its allegiance to. There are things that can be done self-correcting by the board itself. But from the way I've seen, the way that, well, what's happened here over the last year is that the board has sort of become a closed circle, where they only hear their own advice. And the international director has taken a very authoritarian stance on any dissent. I don't think that these state directors that were recently fired, that it all had to do with management style or ethics. I believe that what's happened is you're seeing a closing of the ranks where those who support this international director are embraced, and those that have any voice of dissent are being let go or fired. And whatever excuse needs to be made up to let them go, it's being generated.
So you're saying it's all a move to just cement the power at the top the way it is now? Well, I've never seen anything go public like this before. When you were the international director, James Carrion, did you ever let anybody go?
Well, sure, there were some voices of dissent after I let some state directors go. There was one state director that took his state membership and formed another organization. But you got to keep in mind that there are valid reasons for terminating volunteer positions. One of them is that the volunteer isn't really volunteering. But in the case of some of these state directors that were recently let go, especially with Leslie Barnacle from Colorado, who was a 40-year MUFON member and just an outstanding state director. She was the one who not only increased Colorado's membership, but she also successfully ran the symposiums. I think it was four or five different symposiums in the state of Colorado over a number of years. And so MUFON owes her a tremendous debt for the work she's done. And so the fact that she was let go and for management-style issues just doesn't wash for me at all. I'd like to make a public statement about Leslie and why I think she was let go.
Go ahead.
Earlier this year at the MUFON Symposium, MUFON has a state directors meeting every year at the symposium. At the state directors meeting, Leslie recorded the state directors meeting on audio, and that recording came to me. And that audio recording is what I actually am probably going to use as the basis of a libel suit against MUFON, because things were said in that meeting that were untrue about me. And so this is one of the reasons why I think Leslie was let go, because I believe that Clifford Cliff believes that Leslie was the one who released the audio. So, and I think that using the management style or the lack of management was just an excuse for letting her go.
So this libel suit, is it about what they said at that board meeting or a whole lot of things, other things?
For many things they said about me, not just that.
We have another half hour to go with James Carrion, former international director at MUFON. This is a tell-all session. James, before we end this first half hour, did you ever let any volunteers go, state directors?
Sure, absolutely. There were state directors that were let go because they simply didn't do their job. They liked the position, they loved their position, they loved their title, but they weren't willing to do the work. So there were some of those state directors that were let go.
James Carrion, I do appreciate you coming on. We still have about a half hour to go. You brought up the legal angle. I want to ask you something about something I've heard. I heard you had to get a lawyer to collect the reimbursement for the money you spent on the San Jose MUFON convention. Is that true?
Absolutely.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, here's the problem, Jerry. What happened at the states at the symposium in San Jose is there was a shortfall, and MUFON lost money that year. So I basically put up my own funds to cover the shortfall. And I didn't really ask MUFON to pay me back right away. I figured they would eventually pay me back. At one of our board meetings, the board members said, well, you know what, we have this MUFON Bass project going. We're getting this money coming in from Bass. Why don't you just reimburse yourself from those funds? Which was a misuse of Bass funds. So here we have the same board members who were scapegoating me for why they thought the MUFON Bass relationship went sour. And they were telling Bass that they didn't provide proper oversight of how I managed the project. These were the folks that were directing me to misuse funds. The hypocrisy is astounding. So what happened was after I resigned from MUFON, of course I said, well, hey, guys, you still owe me $14,000. I'd like that back. Actually, it came out to be about $12,000 because I already reimbursed myself for two of those while I was MUFON director. And rather than say, okay, well, thank you for lending us the money and writing me a check, they decided to write me an email that said, we don't think that this is a valid charge, and you have to show proof. And we also think that because of these other circumstances surrounding your resignation, we don't really owe you this money. Well, that really set me off, and you can imagine. Mm-hmm. So I just went to my attorney and said, listen, send him a demand letter, and let's be done with it. And that's exactly what happened.
And they paid it.
Plus attorney fees.
I'm curious about the terms of the contract here. Are you saying that the money they gave MUFON, you gave back to them for their expenses when they did this fast-track investigation?
No, keep in mind that the money that MUFON received from Bass was spent on the project. Every dollar was spent on the project. The problem was it only went to project expenses, and any money that was left over that should have been MUFON's money.
I don't know, $300,000 or more sounds like a lot of money to me. Where did it all go?
Okay, so let me explain. So the way those funds were spent were on salaries for the people managing the project. They were spent on fees paid to investigators to go out and investigate. They were spent on plane tickets, on reimbursement for travel, for hotel, for equipment that was needed on site. So that money, whatever the amount, total amount was, every dollar of it went to the project.
Okay, let's make this crystal clear. You don't think anybody just put some of this money in their pocket?
No. None of the funds were embezzled. None of them were mismanaged or misused. And, in fact, I was authorized to draw a personal salary from it of roughly, I don't know, I think it was like $3,000 a month. What I did was I didn't take the salary. I donated it back to the organization instead.
How expensive is it to run MUFON? I mean, you have a lot of volunteers, but you do have paid staff, right?
There's paid staff. There's a lot of correspondence that goes in and out of the organization. There's the management of the membership. There's the creation and publication of the MUFON Journal. There's expenses for online services from the website. There's expenses for a telephone. So like any organization, there's going to be managerial and operational expenses. And basically MUFON is able to stay in the black, but barely in the black, just based on the membership fees and the merchandise itself. So there is no real money left over for doing what MUFON's primary mission is, which is the actual scientific investigation part of it. So there is no money for research scientists or for research projects. It pretty much just covers operations.
James, it's taken you a little while to come forward here from the time the events happened. Why did you come forward? Why did you go public?
Keep in mind that when I resigned, it was sort of a shock to me that the board had turned on me so readily and so easily. And, you know, I thought at the time, you know what, if this organization has changed character and is performing unethically, I'm going to wait. I'm going to bide my time. They're going to shoot themselves in the foot more than once. And over the last year, we've seen that with these state directors being fired. We see this with continued rumors of information flowing to Bass. And my feeling is that now is the time, the opportune time, for the MUFON membership to see what its board is really up to. And it's not just James Carrion saying this. It's saying it's a bunch of ex-state directors who were productive state directors and who were pushed out because they were seen as voices of dissent to an organization that wants to close ranks and manage its image more than its mission.
Are you suggesting that maybe you should come back to MUFON?
Absolutely not.
Okay. You're not trying to get the job back.
Absolutely not. I'm a MUFON benefactor. I'm a lifetime member. I'll be getting my MUFON journal unless they unethically take that away from me. There's some rumors they've done that to other benefactors. And I support the organization, but I will never resume the leadership of that organization or desire any leadership position in the organization.
Seems there's quite a group here that's disenchanted with MUFON. But what can you guys really do? I mean, you already said it's not a democracy.
Well, that's the problem. They simply can't do anything. As long as the board maintains its control and doesn't allow for a democratic process and closes its ranks, it's more than likely that change won't be forthcoming. But I think that when, as word is starting to get out about the state director's firings, my blog talks about the unethical behavior of the board. That where MUFON's going to see a backlash is on how the public perceives it, or even how the IRS perceives it. Imagine the IRS looking into MUFON's financial records and saying, wait a minute, folks, why are you, you don't seem to be actually performing your mission towards the public, so why should we allow you to keep your charitable status? So something's going to bite MUFON in the ass, and pardon my French there.
No, that's fine.
The bottom line is you cannot run an organization under such unethical behavior and survive for long. So whether change comes from within or from without.
James, it seems to me that MUFON's in danger of being NICAP'd. By that, I mean, you know what happened to NICAP. Had all this innuendo about government agents and everything like that. I mean, they finally had to shut the doors in 1980. Same thing could happen to MUFON.
Well, it's definitely a possibility. It's why in my blog article when I talked about how to take down a UFO organization, if there are outside forces that wish that to happen, those outside forces will probably be...
On your blogs, James, you have indicated that... You even named the U.S. Air Force Office of Special Investigations one time. I mean, you're indicating that there's some government intervention here causing havoc.
Well, there's
to obfuscate everything. You have any proof of that?
No, I have no. I definitely have no.
I hate it when people ask me that.
Yeah, I definitely have no concrete proof other than the patterns of activity I've seen while I was in the organization. You have to ask yourself, why is it that their money flows to a UFO organization from an outside party, normally, what we've seen in terms of outside influence is when it comes to these intelligence agencies, they have a desire to control. And if they can control, they will. If they can't control, then they'll terminate. So the question is whether or not MUFON is currently being controlled or not. If it's controlled, it may survive because these outside agencies wish to maintain that control. But if there's if it operates within the constraints that the organization or the intelligence agencies would like it to operate within, it may survive. But if it can't control MUFON and it operates outside of its own box, then we will see efforts for it to be terminated the same way NICAP was.
Well, I mean, if MUFON shut down, what would replace it? What would replace MUFON?
To be honest, I don't think anything will really replace MUFON.
Well, I mean, I've heard talk, you know, that maybe it's time for MUFON to go.
Well, I can tell you that in the Internet age, what may replace MUFON is the Internet, which in itself is a very scary proposition because the Internet itself and all of these message boards like the Open Minds Forum or Above Top Secret or UFO Casebook are just mindless, or I should say faceless, anonymous people that are managing the UFO message, which means that without real people with real resumes in a real organization, if MUFON goes away and it's replaced by information flowing on the Internet, then the waters of ufology have become that much muddier.
Well, I can't disagree with that statement, but let's get back to Bigelow for a minute. Do you think he's using government money? I mean, or you know, he paid you a lot of money. MUFON, I mean, where'd that money come from? I mean, I know he's got money.
I can't tell you what the source is because I don't know the source.
Uh-huh.
I do know that I was told that did not come from Bigelow's funds. There were third party sponsors that put up the money, and the board members, MUFON board members, with the exception of John Schuessler, were not told who those sponsors were. So who the source of, I can tell you that in the meeting I had with Bigelow before we signed the project deal, is I specifically asked him if there was government money behind it.
By all accounts, James, your relationship with Bigelow deteriorated for whatever reasons, and you've discussed some of them tonight. In other words, are you pure of heart with MUFON, or are you just not like the man?
No, I have no problem with Mr. Bigelow personally.
I mean, see, we hear rumors, and I just want to get that out to the audience. Okay, it's glad to hear
no,
that.
No, absolutely not. I do distrust the intentions of his organization, BASS, and the reason I distrust the BASS organization is because of its predecessor, NIDS, and its relationship to that ranch in Utah that Mr. Bigelow owns.
Now, to get this interview, I agreed not to address that because you have it in a blog, which we have a link to, by the way. You just published it today. But you discuss a lot about the Skinwalker Ranch, and basically you don't believe much of it. Well, you know, you have that non-disclosure clause, but personally, I think that's null and void, so I think you could talk about it.
Well, that's for an attorney to interpret. I'm working off of my conscience right now.
And your conscience wants to do what about MUFON?
I don't want the board to leave. I want the board to live up to its responsibility and to who its primary customers are, which is the general public.
Time will tell what's next for MUFON. What's next for James Carrion? What's happening with you?
Well, next for me is I still have a computer training company that I run that keeps me primarily busy. On the UFO scene, I'm doing personal research. I have an organization I started called the Center for UFO Truth. It's based on some original research I did, and I presented at the MUFON Symposium and at the Crash Retrieval Conference. And it focuses on the early days of UFOs, during the 2 month period in 1947 where we have Roswell and Maury Island and Kenneth Arnold. My belief is that those three events are related, that they're not UFO related, that there was some grand deception operation that was in place that had to do with the Cold War that triggered those three events. And my aim is to prove
James,
that.
Before you go, I have to ask you a direct question. When you were international director or just at MUFON, at the headquarters, were you ever approached by any member of any of the alphabet agencies of the United States government to try to buy influence or influence you in any way?
I was never approached by anyone supposedly in the know, but I think there's a reason for that, and that's because I made it very public that I was not going to deal with so-called insiders who claim to have inside knowledge of the UFO phenomena, because that game has been played by way too many ufologists who have been discredited, from Bill Moore to even some of the folks currently in ufology, like Linda Moulton Howe, and even some of the stories I've heard from John Schuessler. If you play that game, you bite on that carrot, you'll end up with no information.
Now, before you leave, I just want to make sure I have this right and how James Carrion is thinking. You think the MUFON board and the people at the top of MUFON at this time probably are fairly honorable, but they're just not responsible to the public? Is that right?
The problem is that they take a blind eye to the truth. And as you'll see on my board, my blog tomorrow, how they took a blind eye to the truth or to the possibility that they're being controlled and managed. Their belief in the subject blinds them to what their mission statement truly is, which is to be scientific investigation. It should not be about their own personal beliefs. It should not be what they think is happening. It should be based on rigorous science. It should be based on skeptical outlook, and it should be based on evidentiary standards, none of which is present currently in the organization. I do want to make a final statement, and that is, again, I'm not trying to bring MUFON down. I would like to see it survive, but I would like it to see it survive and perform its mission, which it's not currently. There are a lot of good people in MUFON who are hardworking, they're volunteers, they give of their own time and of their own money, and those folks deserve better from their leadership. And MUFON members deserve more from their leadership, and the public at large deserves more from MUFON leadership.
James, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Jerry. I really appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Tales of High Strangeness. Jerry Pippin Sparrowzo. Check out our story. Of the horrific, the interesting, the spiritual, on the paranormal pages of JerryPippin.com. The Mutual UFO Reporting Network has been in existence for about 40 years. A little over 100 days ago, this organization started their STAR Team Investigations Unit, a rapid response team, ready at a moment's notice when a major UFO sighting or incident is reported. They are ready to investigate.
That northwest of Detroit, did you see that light?
Yeah.
Well, that's what I saw, a real bright white light, sometimes flickering underneath the clouds. This is what I saw.
Air Shuttle 5959, is that traffic that you saw earlier, did you see him out there any longer?
Yeah, Air Shuttle 5959, and that's affirmative, and it's a light that kind of, it goes dim and it gets bright. I don't know if we're getting closer to it or what, but it looks like a rotating light around it, like a frisbee type thing that's going around it. So,
Wasaba 3179, do you see the same thing?
Sir, I saw it coming out of Detroit. I wondered, all I saw was just a couple real bright flashes of light, and it almost looked like lightning, and it caught my eye, and then I kept watching it, and then it looked a little bit less bright, but it looked like it was underneath the cloud deck to me, and this was just as we were coming out of Detroit.
Yeah, hey, just to keep this advised, we're descending to 4,000 feet right now, and as we descend to 10,000 feet, that object is above us right now. It is not on the ground. It's about 10,000 feet.
We're checking on it right now. I still don't have anything out in front of you at all that I'm showing it. I appreciate you coming back to the frequency and letting me know.
I'll keep it right. I'll tell you what, that is weird. If you're sitting up all day.
Basaba 3179, when you flashed your lights, did you get any response? Okay.
That was an actual recording of an incident involving the air control operations at Cleveland, Ohio. For years, these lights in the sky would get investigated on a more or less casual basis. But now, using the latest technology, MUFON's STAR team is doing some amazing investigations into close encounters, abduction reports, mysterious beings in the night. These investigations occur almost instantly. You have heard a lot about MUFON over the past weeks on this show, and we thought it was time to reveal exactly what is happening with their fast-track investigations unit known as the STAR Team. On the line from Memphis, Tennessee, we have Chase Klotsky. She's Deputy Director of Investigations and STAR Team Manager for MUFON. Chase, welcome to the show, and how are you today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
Chase, let's get right to it. You're the star team manager for MUPON, and explain to our audience exactly what the star team is.
Well, the star team project is a rapid response and deployment strategy that basically targets high-value investigations. We typically accept the most experienced forensic-minded volunteers in MUFON. We also have team specialists that assist in things like laboratory and photo analysis, aviation, artifact recovery. We also have designed four-star team to identify certain cases and events that are national, a system called MATCON, and that stands for MUFON Activity Condition. So we have a MATCON administrator, and I also have one CMS administrator who has actually been with me since day one. And we investigate the most complicated and high-profile cases that are reported to us through our case management system.
Chase, do you physically go to these cases, or are you just administrative? I mean, assign people?
Basically, kind of oversee and organize the investigations. As I don't physically go there. I'd love to. That would be great, but I'm not necessary. I'm more the organizer. So it's my job to identify when we have these Category 3s or star team triggers that kind of complicate some of the cases, and from there, I contact the state directors, and I mostly work with them. The state directors are probably the biggest role in the star team deployment and the greatest asset because of their logistics, information, and knowledge of the state.
So these reports that the state directors are not involved, that's wrong.
Yeah, that's absolutely wrong. And the state directors are my main point of contact. I very rarely talk to the investigators unless the state director chooses that to happen. But it's their choice. So if we have a case that comes up and I contact the state director, and, you know, life happens. You know, they may have jobs or other responsibilities, family matters at the moment. And they direct me to what we call a star team coordinator in their state. Then that would be my direct point of contact. But the state directors completely run all events in their state as to even who I talk to as far as coordination. Absolutely.
Chase, when did the star team concept come into existence? I mean, it actually, started.
We launched, believe it or not, October 15th, and it's growing so fast, and things are happening so fast, and the information revealed from star team has been so significant, it's kind of hard to believe we're barely 100 days old. It really is. I feel like I've been doing this for quite some time, but we've only been launched since October, yes.
You told me in an email that you had 9 cases recently, and I guess 3 of those have been solved already?
Some of them have. We typically report, the most sensational, of course, you know, the big events that are yielding information that, you know, ufologists and other people are interested in. We have several cases going on, but usually, you know, like everyone else knows, when you're investigating, you have to chase 100 to get that one. And we are getting that one, but we're also chasing the other 99. So we are a very busy team. And we now, I believe, are on 5 full activated events. We are constructing conclusions on 2. And we have a possible on the table this morning. So we're very busy.
So literally, you're getting new cases almost every day.
Yes. MUFON averages a little over 500 cases a month.
Well, what would trigger the star team? I mean, what kind of cases gets your attention?
The first trigger is absolutely any witness that is reporting physical effects, physical evidence, anything left behind is definitely a star team trigger. usually large events, things when we start seeing things develop into flaps, there's just anything that's a little more complicated that would require some sort of specialty involved with, you know, just a plane investigation. Definitely.
Before the show's over, I want to get into some specific cases if we can. But first of all, I guess let's talk about the STAR team objective for MUFON. I guess it would be to have these STAR teams in every state, maybe more than one in each state.
Yes, that's exactly our goal. In MUFON, to be a field investigator, you go through the training program that involves the field manual, and you take a test. And once you're completed with that training, you kind of start out basic, get used to our CMS and you know, the ethics behind investigating. And once you get your feet on the ground, you just get more experience with more cases. The STAR team takes the most experienced, and we're also looking for forensic-minded investigators. Now, if somebody, you know, with a police background or military background or already comes to us with a specialty, they can apply for the STAR team, and if qualified, absolutely, they're put right on. But our goal is 50 states, and that is happening very quickly. There's so much talent in MUFON, it's kind of easy to fulfill this goal pretty quickly.
Jace, in a previous interview with Clifford Cliff, the International Director, he spoke highly of you. I think it would be appropriate if we told our audience, maybe flesh out a little bit about you. What do you think? Tell us about yourself.
I got this job, I just applied. An email went out, I believe, to everybody stating that they were looking for a new STAR team manager, and at the time, I'm a field investigator. I've never held a state position or anything. I've always been a journal subscriber or a field investigator, and I just realized I had time to invest, and I really, really wanted to have more responsibility and to do more in MUFON, so I applied for it. I felt I had good organizational skills, and, of course, you know, been around the military basically my whole adult life.
I know your husband. He's in the Navy.
And I also work for the Department of Defense as a civilian, as a master trainer, master instructor, and I specialized in active duty readiness.
And what does that mean?
That is, we got them ready for whatever, I guess, their next step was. I worked with the dive teams. I've worked with SEAL teams, Marines, before they went to CQB. We physically got them ready, physically and mentally ready for, you know, strenuous schools. If they were going to dive school, it's a very strenuous activity. So we made sure they were physically able to complete whatever assignment they were given, whether it was training, full deployment. It was my job to get them to that level of readiness.
How long have you been interested in UFOs?
Pretty much my whole life. I joined MUFON in 1996. Being a, you know, military spouse, I haven't always been able to keep up and in the loop in MUFON. We travel all over the world and have been overseas, and so it hasn't always been easy to keep up. But, you know, I did maintain, you know, through books and internet and, you know, very fascinated with it. And when we got back to the States, realized I have to do this. So I got my field investigator certification and have been pursuing it ever since. You know, it kind of depends on where you live and how involved the state directors are as far as meetings and things like that on, you know, the information you get. But I honestly have been a big fan of what MUFON does for many, many years, and I feel very, very fortunate that I get to do this job now.
I understand you're originally from New England, but you're in Tennessee right now, near Memphis?
Right outside of Memphis in a town called Millington. My husband is still active duty. He has 24 years in. He's a submarine officer, and I know the first question going through everyone's mind right now is, what's a submariner doing in Tennessee? But, we're here on a shore duty, and he's a detailer, so that's where we are right now, temporarily. We have about another year left, and who knows what's next.
So the Department of the Navy does not mind a major submarine officer, high-ranking officer, to be, to have his wife involved in UFOs?
Jerry, I seriously have to tell you, I had some concerns about that, and I've heard nothing. He's heard nothing.
Okay.
You know, especially being the Star Team manager. We've had no problems at all. As a matter of fact, the interest that I get from even other wives and other active duty, they just think it's great. They're always asking questions. We go to functions, and as a matter of fact, my neighbor, her husband's a Navy pilot, and she just got her field investigator certification. The interest is just phenomenal. It's growing. People are excited. The giggle effect when you say UFO is leaving, you know, especially in social arenas. I will admit that hopefully I could continue to do this, but honestly, we have not heard anything about it so far. And
I just brought that up because we all have heard the stories that the Navy is the lead agency investigating UFOs, not the Air Force. I mean, you know, that's scuttlebutt around.
And I understand that. I absolutely do. I can tell you.
You haven't had any problems with the Navy at all about it. I want to understand this completely now, Chase, about your UFO interest. I mean, have you seen UFOs?
No. Just always had a fascination, and I think it probably started with TV shows as a kid. And I don't know if the first realization of UFOs came from a movie or, you know, there was always a little bit of the scare factor, but, you know, as I grew, I just became more and more interested. And, of course, books, I remember at 16 reading Chariot of the Gods and, you know, so very fascinated from a very young age. It's just always kind of been with me, but nope, I hadn't seen a UFO that I would consider, you know, something very unexplained that I've witnessed with my own eyes until last year.
And what happened last year?
Last year we had a case in Middle Tennessee, and I was out there with a secondary field investigator, and we did witness a very, very large triangle that flew directly over our heads. There were many lights in the sky. We were out there seeing all of this, and actually throughout the evening there were several incidences for us to witness all sorts of.
Yeah, in a previous interview, Clifford Cliff and I talked about that a little bit, but let's hear from you. You're the first-hand source here.
Yes, that's exactly the case that happened. It was
a close encounter with a 3.5-foot ET. You have to tell us about it.
Haunting. I'm not even going to lie. We had this feeling as I'm experiencing some equipment failure, and I'm trying to figure out the batteries and reloading this stuff. I thought I had a battery drain, which wasn't true. Just everything was frozen and not working. But our batteries had come back online, but I had decided to put fresh batteries into a few of the key pieces of equipment I had out there. And as we were working on that, you know, just this overwhelming sense of fear and just something I've never, ever experienced before. And it was like the whole body. It was terrifying. And
so this feeling of fear was much more than just foreboding.
Absolutely it was. And I remember turning to the witness and the other MUFON investigator and saying, does anybody else feel like you're being watched? And I don't mean from up there, but being observed from here. And it was just a few quick moments after that for some odd reason, nobody said run, nobody said anything. We just knew to get out of there. We all three just turned and ran. It was after we started running, the witness had this large flashlight in his left hand, and we kind of had to turn to where the truck was because we're in the middle of this 60-acre cornfield. I mean, it was just this big open space. And as he turned, the flashlight beam kind of swept across the field, and he stopped and said, you know, what the blank was that? And he turned the flashlight back, and we were running so fast at that point, he had stopped so suddenly, I actually ran into him, and I stopped behind him, and my eyes also went to where he had landed, and that light landed flat on this little being that was just there. It felt a lot longer than that, but mm-hmm. it was really just that one 1002. We just ran after that.
What did it look like?
I have to tell you, I was very shocked because, you know, everything that we read and all the research that I've done and been involved in, it wasn't exactly what I thought it was going to look like. It didn't have those big almond eyes. I call it the cute little Roswell alien. That's not what I saw at all. 3.5 foot, had that gray appearance. It didn't look like it was...
Chase, I need to let the audience know that we have some construction going on here at our studio, and so there'll be some noise in the background, and so we're getting interrupted, but not by the government, it's by carpenters. Now go ahead, tell us a little bit. It did not look like the regular gray.
It just didn't move. There was no reaction from this at all. Not a twitch in a finger or, you know, it was just completely stoic and almost mechanical. However, it was clearly biological. The eyes were kind of more human-like than, you know, the typical, mm-hmm. you know, dark, large almond shape. And I was stunned by the appearance, actually, because it wasn't anything that I expected it to look like. If you're going to see a being, that's kind of my first thing was stunned. The other thing that stood out, I remember the legs being so frail, so twig-like. I was actually shocked at how they even worked and held up the rest of his body. I don't know if that was how the beam of light hit. Obviously, I'm kind of haunted with a million questions.
Mm-hmm.
Why was it there? Was it trying to contact us? Was this being responsible for the fear we felt? How did it get there? A million questions.
So this 3.5 foot creature did not make any noise.
No, and this is something that this happened right after the Tennessee floods, and we were wiped out on the military base. You know, here in Millington, there were 6 to 8 feet of water here, and, you know, we evacuated, and, you know, Nashville was devastated, and the water had just receded. So, you know, this wasn't, you know, just really dried up, you know, farmland or, you know, mm-hmm. anything like that. It was nice, moist soil. When we left the scene and left the cornfield, we were back in the field within 30 minutes. It's almost as though the further away we got from the cornfield, the more that feeling went away. And, of course, reality starts coming in, and I had to get back in the field because now I'm convinced we have evidence. You know, we saw a being, and I want the footprints. I want to go out and find it. Is it still there? You know, there was all these things going through, so we were very anxious to get back out into that field.
Any footprints?
No, we found nothing. I found all of ours. I found the tire tracks. We grid searched. There was nothing. I was very frustrated.
Chase, with no footprints and no record of anything, what do you think? Was it some sort of mass hypnosis, or do you think it was real?
That I can't answer. What mm-hmm. I can tell you is that what happened was real. What I saw was real. Whether I was made to see it or not, I have no information on that. I mean, it was a real event. It was something that had been reported to us previously. The witness is extremely credible, a very high-profile, professional family. And there were many witnesses. We had 7 witnesses, you know, to these events. I'm not sure, Jerry,
mm-hmm.
you know, how it got there, why. It's that being has brought up more questions than, unfortunately, I could answer as a field investigator.
Yeah, I understand.
It's frustrating. And to this day, that area continues to have activity. So we're still watching very closely.
Have there been other incidents investigated by the STAR team like this, similar to this?
Oh, yes. We have many cases that are producing the kind of results that this team was designed for. Our main goal in the STAR team is evidence. My goal is to give MUFON something, whether it's the photo, the piece of evidence, the footprint, the proof. That's what all ufologists are looking for and studying through, and why I'll chase 99 in hopes to get that one. It's just kind of what we do, and that is our job. We do have several other cases that are going on, and of course the STAR team just doesn't deal with what I call the rock and roll cases, where we can go in and grab evidence. We also deal with abductees and experiencers, and we have very highly trained professionals that, you know exactly how to help our witnesses. You know, it's very common for a field investigator to bond somehow and to identify and actually even be, actually even become friends with witnesses because you're included in extraordinary events.
You know, Chase, in business, location, 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 that's the byword. And in investigations and UFO shows I've done over the years, I've always paid particular attention to geography. And you've been at it for 100 days now. Is there something going on in a certain area? I mean, are there hot spots? You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, that's actually identified by our MATCON program. And again, MATCON stands for MUFON Activity Condition. What I noticed was we don't have dispatchers. You know, we don't have teams that sit and, you know, sort through the reports. What happened was when we started the team, I was very fortunate that Sandy Gonzalez had offered to be the STAR team CMS administrator. So every report that comes to MUFON, he kind of goes through and does the categorization with the valet classification. So we have category 1, 2, and 3 cases. He alerts me of every category 2 and 3, and then I go in and study the cases and triage to see when it's appropriate to activate the STAR team. Most recently, we designed a program, this MATCON, and what that does is it helps us to monitor and evaluate events. So all reports are viewed, and then we systematically organize them to reveal important information, such as cluster sightings, flaps, or even vigorous activities. We also kind of target and track to help identify objects that are known to a certain area, such as a military base. With the technology of drones and even special projects, we need to be better identify what's normal for that area and what would not be considered normal, because we do know that it has been reported and studied that UFOs are interested in nuclear sites, airports, military bases. So we do have a specific position that tracks just those specific areas and is working on research on identifying what we call normal events and other than normal. It's a pretty decent program. It's yielding all sorts of information that we kind of didn't expect. It's an amazing program.
We have another half hour to go with this interview with Chase Klotzke, who is in charge of the STAR team investigations for MUFON, Tales of High Strangeness. Jerry Pippin's Parazone. Check out our stories of the horrific, the interesting, the spiritual, on the paranormal pages of JerryPippin.com. We are talking with Chase Klotzke, and she's on the line from outside Memphis. And she has been the key person, really, for the STAR team, the high-tech investigations unit, fast-track unit for MUFON. And she's been busy.
In 50 states, with an organization as popular as MUFON, getting over 500 a month, We're very busy.
Now that's for all of the UFO sightings reports, and then the STAR team takes the cream of the crop, so to speak. Well, one of the reasons we wanted you to come on, and we appreciate you coming on with us, is to explain how detailed this is and what the parameters are.
We are, this program is pretty solid. The first thing I was tasked to do when I accepted the position and offered and accepted the position was to design a program. And I started from nothing. I had nothing. I started on a piece of paper at my kitchen table. I didn't have any information from the last program, and that was okay because so much had changed. The last program was completely different because it was funded. They were paid positions. There was a whole entity that I didn't have. So it wasn't important to me to find out what happened in the last program because most of those issues I wasn't concerned with.
So MUFON didn't steal the BASS program. I mean, you didn't just take it and revamp it.
Not at all. I've never met Mr. Bigelow or talked to him. No, this program is strictly MUFON. And it was, like I said, it was designed with volunteers in mind. There are no paid positions in the STAR team. Everything continues to be grassroots, volunteer. Organizing in our organization our most experienced people and utilizing their talents and identifying at a higher level priority cases.
Chase, if we can, I'd like to get a little more specific about the type of cases that the STAR team, investigates. I mean, what are we talking about? Trace evidence, landings, lights in the sky, abductions?
The STAR team, this is what's great about the STAR team. Having the most experienced and specialized people on board is really very helpful. We have a case in Florida that is producing physical evidence that we're waiting on lab results now before we close it off. I can't wait to reveal this case because it's very, very interesting. A credible witness, several witnesses, several sightings. We have physical evidence. We even have reports of MIB activity where after our investigators, two of Florida's best investigators, we're so thrilled to have them, but it was Morgan Beal and Mary Margaret Zimmer, immediately responded to this scene and effectively and forensically gathered evidence, properly tracked everything, marked it, got it ready to send with a chain of custody to the lab, and in the meantime, effectively interviewed the witnesses and just did an outstanding job. It was reported to us a few days later that the witness had come home and a neighbor had approached him and said that there was a strange vehicle out in front of his house. They weren't sure what to make of it. And upon entering his home and going out in the backyard, he found that the very area that we had investigated had been burned.
Okay, you're not talking about a grass fire here. I mean, you're talking about somebody used a flamethrower or something. They torched it.
We believe through our investigation so far, we're still waiting for lab results to tell us about an accelerant or anything going on. We believe it was a chemical burn, absolutely. It was systematically burned.
Have there been other incidents where a third party shows up and gets involved and,
Yes, there have, which is why there's such a strict confidentiality on the STAR team cases. And I'd like to explain that. This confidentiality has nothing to do with non-disclosure. There is no such thing as a non-disclosure form. That's ridiculous. I don't know a single member in MUFON that is in it to keep secrets. I don't know a single investigator in MUFON that would be comfortable even at the idea of keeping silent about what we do. And there is no such form. No such form. However, we do have confidentiality on active cases. And that confidentiality is to protect our witnesses, and it's to protect our investigators, and basically to protect the evidence that we're after. And that's what the confidentiality is actually for. Several times, I don't know any entity out there that investigates, whether it be an industrial investigation, insurance investigation, crime scene, or UFO, where anybody would say, you know, the public does have a right to know, so come on in and everybody take a look around at what happened, and then we'll explain it as we go along. You know, usually any investigator in any situation would like time to effectively investigate what they're doing. We owe that professionalism to our witnesses who trust us and why they give the reports to MUFON. Because we do investigate. Others report. We investigate. So that confidentiality, we have had people show up at our witnesses' homes before we got there. We've had witnesses contacted by other people. So confidentiality is a big, big concern. It's written right into our procedure manual, an exact chain of communication when we're on active cases. But as soon as these cases are closed, we want to tell the world. We'll tell anybody. We want to publish them. It's what we do. So to think that the confidentiality is going to carry over after a case is closed is ridiculous. I also know that MUFON has this rumor about black hole of information, and, you know, I just don't understand that because Star Team launched October 15th, and in November, December, and January in our journal were two of the biggest cases they had in 2010. I can't wait to put some of the other cases that we're working on, but we need that time. MUFON is a scientific organization. So you can imagine, as a scientific organization, us putting out data without backing it up with the very to us. Does that make sense? You know, and Jerry, I don't know any investigator out there that would be happy and satisfied to even consider something like that. That's not what we do. All the investigators and members I know, or even other ufologists that may not even be with MUFON, we all want the same thing. We want the truth, and we want it out there, and we want to know what the government knows. We want to know what other government knows. You know, people get... Let us know. We want full disclosure.
Okay, that's a good explanation, and I get that explanation from the police departments and from the military and from all investigators. And as a journalist, of course, my object is to get the story as quickly as possible.
Right, and we understand that people want to know, and that's what we do. We just really want the time to let our labs do what they do so that, as a scientific organization, our evidence and the case results that we have can absolutely withstand public and scientific scrutiny, because they are going to be scrutinized. You know, our photo analysis specialist is amazing, and, you know, he knows that when he puts this photo out and verifies, yes, this is authentic, and I don't know what it is, and I can't explain it, that there's probably going to be 500 other people that grab that photo and try to do the same thing. So we have to be specific, especially with the reputation of MUFON being over 40 years of a scientific organization. We have to be that good.
I'm still curious about the specifics of the cases that MUFON investigates. I mean, what kind of cases are we talking about? Are there lots of reports of ETs walking around, or is that a pretty rare report? I mean, what kind of cases are we talking
there,
about?
Anything that yields trace evidence, physical effects, you know, and of course, physical effects could even be your abductions. Right now, we have an abductee in Indiana that we're working with, and he has documented family history as an experiencer. His family has passed lie detector tests, physical exams, psychological evaluations, and right now we're currently in the process of regression therapy and, you know, documenting all the missing time and even some of the physical effects on such things as his vehicle. So, you know, that's a very big case. It's very intricate. We're finalizing some of this, but, you know, it's ongoing.
And this abduction case, was he harmed physically?
That we're not sure of.
Okay.
The regression therapy is ongoing. And we will definitely be able to
Let's get away from the specifics of this individual case and talk about abductions, period. I mean, what's going on there? Are the abductees being harmed or examined, or is it scientific or what? What do you think it is?
The sense I'm getting in the cases that I am specifically involved in, it appears to be more information. The abductees are claiming more information, more connections to claimed hybrids, you know, things like that. It seems to be more informational that we're getting at this point and not so much physical examinations and experiments. I haven't gotten too much of that.
You know, Chase, we're always talking about government disclosure of UFOs and ETs. I've often wondered, why not the ETs just come to MUFON? You guys investigate them all the time.
That would be
they
wonderful.
Know about you, I'm sure.
Yes, but you're absolutely right. And these are questions we discuss among ourselves as well.
I mean, why don't they come to me? I'd love to interview one. Put them right on the air.
And to tell you the truth, I kind of would rather them come to us first, if you know what I mean.
I've never had one come into my room at night when I'm asleep.
Not that I'm aware of. That is Star Team's mission, is to basically get that evidence. When you were talking about some of the cases that we work, we don't necessarily work a lot of lights in the sky. And sometimes people look at these cases as less than. They're not always your most exciting cases, but they are extremely important in MUFON and should always be taken just as seriously as anything else. Lights in the Sky reports reveal a plethora of information, as to hot spots. We're also trying to figure out, how did they get here? How did they work? How did they move? Which is why some of the talent that we incorporate in MUFON are our, you know, physicists and scientists, and, you know, that seems to be as much of a membership boom as you know, people like me, regular field investigators that just have a love for ufology and now have time to invest. So, you know, the professionals, I guess, are the ones that are really, really taking a big interest in getting involved.
Chase, these MUFON shows have generated lots of email, lots of responses. And one thing I've noticed is a lot of people, and I've been doing UFO shows for decades, and you've been, and everybody in MUFON's have been investigating things for a long time, and some people are questioning the objectivity of us simply because we've seen a lot of evidence that makes us think there's something to it. I mean, you can be objective without being skeptical.
Right, and to be honest with you, a healthy dose of skepticism is exactly what we're looking for.
I'm pretty agnostic about it all.
Right. I mean, if you walk in and you know, for every person that says, you know, I feel like I was coming home from work and it took me 4 hours, it's a 20-minute trip, I don't know what happened, and you're rolling your eyes, we don't want you. You know, that's just ridiculous. We're looking for the truth. Now, whether that's UFOs, aliens were being visited, something else may be going on. Our mission is the truth, and which is why when we chase 100 cases, you know, 99 of them, you know, turn out really nothing significant that we can put out and report that we haven't done a million times already. But at the same time, a healthy dose of skepticism, we have to maintain that investigator mode. We have to ask the questions. We have to ask them again. We have to ask them a third time in an open-ended questioning session. We have to look for the evidence. If you're not finding evidence ever, or not getting good cases in your state ever, you know, you might want to retrain some of your FIs to go ahead and go out there. That big case that we had in Tennessee started out as a light in the sky case. It was a Category 1. And, you know, as I interviewed the witness, he appeared more and more credible. I kept asking questions. He was making some pretty extraordinary claims. Orange fireballs, red and white lights in the sky every night. He did report three lights. He never said to me a triangle until we met him. But these were extraordinary claims. And, you know, so my next step was, well, why this area? What's going on? So as I, you know, did the satellite research, I realized it's very rural. We did the soil compound. I found out that we have a sacred site very close to the incident, which are the Pinson Mounds. Very, very sacred site. It's an archaeological park now. We found military bases close enough to have an interest, but far enough away that it wasn't probably something from that. We found ley lines intersecting exactly where some of this activity is going on. So now, as an investigator, it's making more sense to me all the different types of claims versus just a light in the sky. We have to do our job as investigators. We have to take it to the next level and even think out of the box. I contacted the Historical Society because the newspaper wasn't responding. I talked to law enforcement officers out there, and although he was a little tongue-in-cheek, he kind of sat back and was a little intrigued and actually wanted to know exactly where I was investigating in his county.
Yeah.
And, of course, he didn't get that information. But I called the Historical Society because, you know, historians know the events and past, and I was curious to find out if, you know, they knew of any legends even, you know, Mothman, you know, things that, you know, kids grow up on or towns talk about, especially these small towns, that might have this witness automatically assume extraterrestrials. So, you know, to kind of think out of the box and just go for it. And then what I found was, if these things were coming in and all these different types of crafts, it actually made more sense, according to the research and theory in ufology, it actually made more sense here than anywhere else. So, you know, that was interesting.
Over the years in doing these UFO shows, you come to some conclusions or ideas, at least. And Native American burial grounds, there seem to be, you know, there seems to be a connection. Another thing is quartz deposits. Have you ever examined that aspect?
We do. And that is why I did take the soil compositions and studied the makeup of what was underneath top layers. We do. And when I saw when the Pinson Mounds, which I'm not native to Tennessee, I was quite startled to find that. However, it's huge. You know, it's a huge tourist place, an archaeological park. But that made a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. It was.
Another common denominator is fresh water. A lot of these things seem to happen around freshwater areas. Maybe they're taking on water. I don't know.
Well, there's a great book out there written by one of our field investigators called UFOs in Water, and it's probably the most comprehensive. It's taken off of eyewitness testimony and years of research. It's an amazing book, and you know, and of course my husband's a submariner, so UFOs are, I'm very fascinated with UFOs in water.
Yeah, I wonder if he's seen any of those undersea bases we hear about.
I'll tell you.
And I don't want to get him in trouble here.
He doesn't
but
talk about his job, that,
yeah.
You know, oh, I ask. Yes, I ask. And no, he's just kind of looks at me.
Okay. We don't want to get him in trouble, but I'd sure like to know.
You know, we're looking forward to being able to explore this more, and, you know, hopefully he'll retire soon. I'm counting the days and tapping my fingers for it, but that'll be awesome. And he's very interested, too. He would love to do this.
Well, as long as we're talking about the government and the military and all of that, and you mentioned the thing where they burn the evidence in the backyard with a chemical fire down in Florida, and we get reports of this all the time, of possible government interference. What's the deal? I mean, why do they want to cover it up, you think?
You know, again, that's a question that
I don't want to get you in trouble here.
Involved in trying to answer as anything else. It's I believe that they probably have a lot to lose, especially, you know, credibility. I mean, who trusts the government? You know, so now to come out and say, well, okay, yes, we have known this for years and years, and yes, okay, that did happen. You know, the government has absolutely no win in coming out, unfortunately. When we do give them that win, I'm sure that, you know, someday we can convince them to disclose information.
True, Chase. The cover-up of the cover-up of the cover-up always gets you in deeper. Plus, I've known a lot of these people over the years, and a lot of them, you know, you got to know, you got to be in a position to know, a need to know. And so I'm not sure everyone knows. You know what I mean?
Well, and, you know, that's kind of how secret organizations work. You know, you don't tell the left hand what the right hand is doing. You know, we know, for instance, you know, in Area 51 or Dugway, or, you know, you may sit next to the guy on the bus every day as you go and take your Janus Air flight and, you know, talk very civilly and get to know each other, but you don't know where he works, you don't know what he does, and you're not allowed to talk about it. And a lot of, you know, governments have to run that way. It's how you secure information. So if you want to keep a secret, you don't tell 10 people.
I'm not sure the government needs all those secrets. Who's the enemy? Especially in the UFO question, who is the enemy? But that's another question.
Right. That is an excellent question. And, you know, every ufologist is anxious for that answer. You know, who is our enemy? Why? Why keep it secret?
Well, you know, something may be nefarious. I mean, why are we keeping it such a big damn secret? I mean, I sometimes wonder if the ETs are up to any good. Maybe there's a group that isn't. What do you think?
I don't.
Have you seen any evidence of that?
I don't see any evidence of that. The evidence, I have to look back on what I've personally investigated and witnessed, and it just seems to be no different than our behavior when we come across, you know, a place we haven't gone to in the rainforest, where we want to examine, you know, the living creatures and how they work and how they colonize and, you know, are they hive-minded? You know, we study them and, you know, eventually as humans we'll take an experiment. My experience is more towards observation study. You know, I'm not so sure. I know all the movies coming out, which is kind of good for MUFON because pop culture has an influence on our membership.
Yes,
you know,
it does.
In the 80s when we had like 6,000 members, you know, the height of E.T. and Close Encounters and all these great movies and TV shows, V, and, you know, and then, of course, we had another surge with The X-Files. So I'm actually looking forward to all these movies coming out. MUFON membership has fluctuated up and down with pop culture and the popularity of UFOs and the interest in society in them. However, the one thing that has never gone down are our field investigators. That number has never declined. So, you know, that's something we think about. But it'll be interesting because Hollywood puts out, you know, bad aliens, you know, aliens versus humans, alien versus predators, you know. So they have a very different message. and, you know, that's curious.
I think it's more than curious. I think somebody out there doesn't want us to know something. But speaking of secrets, let's get back to MUFON. There's no secrets about the STAR team with the state directors, right?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, the non-disclosure fantasy agreement is, you know, ridiculous. Like I said, Jerry, and you must know a lot of MUFON people. Do you know anybody that would sign something like that, let alone come up with that idea? Also, it's probably important to know that the state directors themselves are responsible for reporting activity to headquarters and to their membership. I mean, you know, if for example, you know, Colorado had 50 cases in the last 90 days, where are they? Who's responsible for putting that information out? Well, that's the state director. You know, our international director certainly couldn't call 50 states and state directors and field investigators, you know, every week to find out where they are in cases. You know, it's clearly outlined in the state director's manual that they are personally responsible for the disclosure of their own cases, for their own reporting. And when they have something, they need to put it out there. We couldn't call every state director every month and say, hey, you guys got anything for me? You know, it's very clearly outlined in their manual what the responsibilities are. They're also responsible for recruiting their membership in their states. And, you know, so sometimes I'm a little disheartened when I hear, well, MUFON's losing membership. Well, whose fault is that? Whose responsibility is this? Well, it falls back on the state directors. Now, with that said, that kind of sounds negative. That's how important our state directors are and why we treat them with such respect and pay a lot of attention to, you know, what they're doing and what they need, is because they are the direct line, absolutely, between a national organization, an international organization, and where I come from not too long ago, the FI in the field, that standing there with a field manual, a MUFON equipment bag, big eyes, wanting to go on investigations. So it's very important what they do, and they need to do it right. And they need to do it in a conscious and effective way for the betterment of our organization and the very people they serve.
Okay, secondly, as soon as the case is closed, as soon as the investigation's over, it's open to the public.
Absolutely.
You don't have some cases that have been hanging around for years and somebody's hiding them.
Not that I know of.
Okay.
You know, like I said, since October as STAR team manager, I've had two of the biggest cases in MUFON in the journal. And we've been all over, you know, radio interviews and putting this information out. So, no, that's not my experience at all. Not at all.
You don't have any negativity about MUFON. You're positive about MUFON, right?
About MUFON. I'll be honest with you, Jerry. I put in, without exaggerating, easily 60 to 70 hours a week. I wouldn't put that kind of time, money, effort, even a little risking, you know, ridicule in my own community, which I have not experienced. I have half expected a knock on my door, which we have not gotten. You know, I wouldn't risk all this for an organization that I thought was not full on and truthful and open. It's just not my experience, Jerry. It really isn't.
Any closing comment?
Just thank you so much for, you know, getting the message out there and having us and caring enough about what the truth is. And that really is what we are. We're truth seekers. We're ufologists, and we are MUFON. And I would like to invite anybody to, you know, please ask us questions. If you have a question with the STAR team, call me. Ask me. We're on Facebook. Just, you know, search out STAR Team Project. We're, you know, all our information, all my information's out there. So please contact me, ask me questions, and we will respond. We'll give you every honest answer. But watch us walk our talk. That's what's going to show where MUFON stands. We are walking our talk.
Thank you very much, Chase.
You're welcome. Thank you.
As you know, MUFON has a new international director. He's Clifford Cliff, and he's on the line with us right now. Cliff, or I guess it's Clifford, right? I love that. You're not in Denver, though, are you?
Jerry, I'm in Greeley, Colorado.
Oh, okay, I know where it is.
Oh, do you?
So you're actually the director now. You took over earlier in February, I believe.
I am, as of last week.
So you actually spent the week before Valentine's Day and this week settling into the job, I guess.
Slowly, but yes. It's a great job. It's a big job. I didn't realize how, even though I've been on the board of directors, I didn't realize how much work the ID had to do.
Well, I guess that's why James Carrion, your predecessor, only wanted to serve the one term, huh?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, James had some business situations and family situations he needed to address, and he needed to move on to those, take care of personal matters. So we decided that then I could be the the board of directors decided that I would be the international director. And
now, Clifford, contrary to a lot of rumors, you're no stranger to MUFON. You've been around that organization for a while,
yes,
right?
Yes, I've been on the board of directors about 8 years and came on with John Schuessler and Jan Harzan and Dr. Bob Wood. Came on about 8 years ago.
John Schuessler. I like him. Do you see him often? I think he's still
John,
around.
John, I talk to at least once or twice a week, and I see him about once a month. He is a magnificent human being. He just is wonderful.
I'm sure John was all the things you just mentioned. What we liked about him was he was always available, or at least willing to talk to us about anything that came up. Hope you'll do the same thing. John was quite a guy, and is quite a guy.
And that's the way he is. I have never met a more open person, honest and straightforward as John Schuessler.
Okay, you're taking over for James Carrion, and James did some pretty good technical things for sure that I know of. I mean, it looks to me like you guys are headed in the right direction.
James did some. He brought us to the 21st century with the computer technology and all of the things that are needed for us to work in this field, and he's done an excellent job with that. I see myself, Jerry, as moving forward with MUFON, trying to be a centrist. When I say that, what I mean is, on one hand, we have the people that are the nuts and bolts of the UFO. The machine's got to be right there in front of you before it's a valid consideration of the existence of the UFO. On the other hand, clearly on the other side, we approach the paranormal side of the UFO phenomenon. Now, in my opinion, they are all both, from all the way across the spectrum, have valid considerations that we need to investigate. And hopefully we'll be able to do that. As a matter of fact, the symposium this year, we are going to have the theme is going to be the cutting edge of UFO investigations, and we will have the abduction people, we'll have crop circles, and we will have the hard evidence about UFO machines.
Well, you know, I always have thought of myself, Clifford, as a nuts and bolts guy. I want to knock on the door of the saucer and interview somebody in there, but there's more to it.
There's something going on that we just don't have the capability with our limited intelligence to get a handle on it. I've done brainwave trainings with Dr. Bob Schellenberger and Judy Green, the daughter of Elmer Green from the Menninger Institute in Topeka, Kansas. And there are some things that happen. People believe they might be paranormal. I don't know if they are. I think they might be just another aspect of our mind that we haven't been able to really get a grasp of yet. So we can't rule that part of it out.
Okay, now, the MUFON symposium this year is moving back to Denver. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, it is, Jerry. July 23rd, 24th, and 25th. Bud Hopkins, Linda Moulton Howe, going to be there, and Nick Redfern. We have pretty good cast that will try to cover all of the aspects of the UFO phenomenon.
Okay, Clifford Cliff, let's let the audience know who you are as a person. Kind of flesh out your personal life for us, if you don't mind. How did you get interested in UFOs and why?
Jerry,
can you answer that?
Yeah, I can, because it started significantly back in the early 50s during the Ground Observer Corps days. You may not be old enough to remember that.
Well, I'm old enough, but explain it to the audience.
Back in the early 50s, the U.S. Air Force was setting up Ground Observer Corps spots across the United States. And as I recall and remember, they were setting it up to develop better radar techniques to see if, in fact, what they were seeing on radar was actually what they were seeing. And I was out in northeastern Colorado in a little town, and my grandmother, who volunteered me for everything, a 14-year-old boy, you know how that goes. And so they called the alert, and we went out to the site. It was in the evening. It was supposed to be from the 8 to 10 tour of duty for that night. They called the alert. We went out, and then you reported the airplanes high, whether it was a jet or a prop, what direction it was going, estimated speed, estimated altitude, and that type of thing, and you would call in your reports. The strange thing is, I still remember our call signs, Bravo Lima Red 1. Anyway, that night I was standing out there, and there were some high fluffy clouds moving across the sky, and there was a full moon just coming up in the east. All of a sudden, off to the southeast, I saw this movement, and I looked up, and here came this object across the sky. It was about the size of the moon. It had something coming off of the back of it, like fire or sparks or something, but not very long. It was very close to the object. It wasn't leaving a long trail. It was just almost a part of it. And it zipped clear across the sky very quickly. To this day, I still shudder and quiver when I think about it, but we called it in, and they bumped us up three or four people before some major said, well, that's what we were looking for. You guys can go home.
Hmm.
So I knew it wasn't an airplane. I knew it wasn't a helicopter. And, of course, satellites were not of consequence at that time. So I had no idea. It was a UFO as far as I was concerned. I have no idea what it was, but it didn't take long for it to move clear across the sky.
The major indicated that he already knew about it. You confirmed
that. That's what he indicated. He said, well, that's what we're looking for. You can go home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That piqued my interest, Jerry, and got me going. And then, of course, into high school, I wasn't thinking that much about him because I was more interested in sports and girls.
I'm the same here, but it was girls and sports.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, yeah, okay. So then I went to college, and of course, I retained interest in it and talked to people about it from time to time, but it wasn't a burning thing in me like
right.
It is today. And then I went into, I was drafted during 62, during the Vietnam era, and went into the Army Security Agency as a communications intelligence operator stationed in Ethiopia. Never saw anything in the CIA reports or that type of thing. I had a top secret crypto clearance.
Mm-hmm.
And I never saw anything pertaining to UFOs, so there was that what didn't happen, but I was always looking. Then, of course, you get married and start going, and then I had the time to start getting involved with it and started reading articles, Flying Saucer Review and some of the books of Hynek and Springfield and the guys that know about it.
Right.
Piqued my interest. Then I had another sighting out here where I live. I spent 35 years, Jerry, in as a real estate person. I had developments. I developed affordable housing, some 500 single-family units and thousands of lots. And I had four real estate offices and some 75 real estate agents that I was taking care of. So I had offices, four offices, two in Greeley and one out in eastern Colorado and one in Windsor.
Mm-hmm.
So that that kept me quite busy. But after the 35 years, I still continued to keep my interest in the UFO field. And then as I got toward the end of retirement, when I, my wife and I decided we wanted to raise Christmas trees, that was probably at a weaker moment in my life. So I, we started raising some Christmas trees, and we still are. But I, we live out in the country, and one evening, Jerry, this one really got me going. I'd already, this was about 5 years ago. I went out of the backyard or the side of the house about 10:30 one night, and we live a mile south of the Greeley Airport. So I see a lot of airplanes coming in and out, nothing too big, but small airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
Off to the east, I saw this orange light on the horizon. I thought, well, that's an airplane running lights. I stood there and watched it for a while, and not very long, like 15, 20 seconds, and it just kept coming. And it wasn't any red or green, it was orange. And the closer it got to be about the size of a penny at arm's length.
Uh-huh.
And it appeared to be to the north, right over, we just, there is a top secret NORAD facility at this airport under the Air Army or the Air National Guard,
mm-hmm.
that they have just had there for about 7 years now. So it was flying right over that area. Well, I knew it wasn't a satellite because they don't go from east to west. It was orange, and it appeared as if it was moving with some difficulty, but it was still maintaining exactly the same speed.
Clifford, are you saying this thing was wobbling?
No, it wasn't wobbling. It was like it was trying to maintain, it would slow up just a little bit and then speed up. So
mm-hmm.
just kind of to try to maintain a certain speed.
Okay.
And it just, I stood there mesmerized. I couldn't even go in and get my wife or get the camera. which happens, I guess, to a lot of people that see things. So anyway, it went on over. Well, I got to thinking, well, what is that? It's no sound, and it wasn't. It was. I was within a mile of it easily. It was under the clouds, and it went right straight over the top of Greeley, and disappeared into the haze. So I don't know. It would appear to me that when it reached the mountains, it would have had to have gone up in altitude to get over them because it was that low.
Mm-hmm.
And we're at 4,500 feet, and the mountains go up to another 10,000 feet. Well, not quite 10,000, but 9,500 feet. So I knew it would have had to have climbed over those if it had kept going in that at that altitude. That really excited me because it was the typical orange color, and it was at low altitude, and it was no sound. I do have a two million candle watt flashlight. I didn't even have the time to think about or even take it out and shine it on it to see if I could get a response. So that's obviously kept my interest piqued in this phenomenon, and it wasn't paranormal or anything else. It was a physical object.
To this day, you probably still think about it. I wonder what that was.
Oh, yes. I still, this increases my desire to investigate what this phenomenon's about.
Your title is International Director, and that's really true. MUFON is an international director. It's around the world now.
Right.
MUFON's done some tremendous changes. I like this real-time reporting. I heard you were going to change that back or something, delay it?
No, I don't know that we will.
Okay.
We had that contract with Bass Aerospace for 10 months, which ended at the end of January, and we will be reevaluating. Bass and MUFON will evaluate the results of that to see whether we want to continue or not. And it's been really exciting to be able to do that because it has increased our sighting reports significantly. We're averaging somewhere around 500 sighting reports a month. Now, that's not to George Filer or to Davenport with the UFO Reporting Center and the others, so we know there's significant amount going on.
There are significant UFO reports, and our hats are off to the people, men and women of MUFON, for doing their part in the UFO research business. If you'd like to hear the entire interview with Clifford Cliff, it's available on our MUFON section at jerrypippin.com. Our time's up. Thanks for listening, everybody. Until next time, cheers.
The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
And if the hippies and the yippies and the disruptors of the systems will shut up,
the amended spiritual experience.
Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley.
Okay, we had a problem here.
P is equal to MC squared.
The message is very simple. Think for yourself and question authority.
Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to Shadows in the Dark, live from Charleston, South Carolina tonight. And I do apologize there for kind of the late start. Looks like we're having either a server issue or something going on, but we got it fixed. We are on now. And of course, through the last 3 years, we've had our fair share of technical issues. So nothing new to us, but I do want to welcome everybody to the show. And like I said, we are broadcasting live from Charleston, South Carolina tonight. And not only from Charleston, South Carolina, but we are at the historic Charleston Foundation, the building here in in Charleston, South Carolina. And I tell you what, we have, of course, now it's getting a little dark outside. We can't see the ocean as well. But for a little bit there, we had a nice ocean view right here at the broadcast table. But we're going to be joined by a few from the historic Charleston Foundation, and we'll introduce them here in a minute. But I did want to talk to you, or not really talk to you, but tell you a little bit about something we've got going on, some changes that we have finally decided on. And as you know, last show we talked about changing the show name. We felt that we have outgrown Shadows in the Dark, that we have gone way beyond what the show originally started as, and that was a paranormal talk show. We're not ashamed to say that. But we have, we've got to where we're talking about so much stuff, interviewing so many different people, bringing so many topics to the show that we felt it just wasn't fitting anymore. And one of the problems was when we go to book a show, we had to explain exactly what the show was about. So at that point, we realized, well, the name did not sum up the show. Well, we did decide on a show name, and we went through a lot of names, many different ones. We had quite a few people working on that, but we finally decided on one that was the simplest, one that was probably going to be the easiest to transition. Now, I'm not real fond of it myself, and you'll understand here in just a minute when I tell you what it is. But I'll get over it over time, and that is Jeremiah Greer Live. One of the things I didn't want the show to ever become is some kind of ego trip, and, to me, that name can somewhat say that. But for those who have listened to us for the last 3 years, and those who hopefully will listen to us in the future, they'll quickly realize this is not an ego trip. This show is not about Jeremiah Greer, but it's about life itself and that journey through life. And in my opinion, if you're going to explore life, then you have to look at all aspects of life. And that's where we're going with the show. Essentially, the show will not change. We'll still talk about all the same topics. You're going to see a lot more segments. A couple of them we are going to introduce is 9 to 5 My Way, which will highlight businesses that are unique, unusual businesses. People who decided to you know, do their 9-to-5 the way they wanted to. So that's going to be a new segment. We're going to have 10 million ways to yes. And I do want to thank Robert Schneck for that name. It is I really like the name of that segment. But 10 million ways to yes, we'll look at, human nature and how we respond to certain circumstances and how we can use that understanding of human nature to move forward, to get positive results of what we're trying to do. And some examples would be, let's say a poker player. A poker player has to understand human nature to be a successful poker player. So we may have a professional poker player on the show to talk about, you know, how they identify the tells. How do people respond to different things? What do they look at the poker table? Advertisement. Advertisement is a huge thing where understanding human nature is essential. Well, we're going to look at getting advertisers on. So a wide range of people. Now, that's just a couple of the topics that we are, our segments that we are going to start introducing, as well as many others. We're still going to keep the Shadows Throwdown, but we're going to rename it, I don't know, probably just the Throwdown. That's just a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun with that one. Also, the playing of the old-time radio shows, Long John Neville, things like that. Those will still be around. So, but we hope to, you know, again, continue the evolution that the show has seen, especially over the last few months. The 24-hour bash, that'll still continue every year at Ripley's, as long as Ripley's has no problem. I don't see why they would have a problem with us changing our name. Again, it's essentially still the same show. So that's what the new name's going to be, Jeremiah Greer Live. Now, we are going to change the URL, and we do apologize because we just changed the URL a month ago. I know we just launched SITDRadio.com, and here we go changing it again. But the good thing is about Jeremiah Greer Live is we don't ever have to change it again. We can do whatever we want to under that name, and it doesn't matter, whereas Shadows in the Dark does hint at the paranormal, the strange, the unusual, and we've gone far beyond that here lately. So I think this name is going to be very fitting and give us, again, the opportunity to just do whatever we want to on the show here. And, we've pretty much done that in the past, and we're going to continue to do that. But enough of that. So you'll see more of that on the website as we, you know, make those changes. You'll see the logo change, all that good stuff. It will be JeremiahGreerLive.com. And I'm looking forward to it. I think it's a good move. I think it's going to help us to move the show forward and do the things we want to. But I tell you what, we've got a lot about Charleston, South Carolina to talk about tonight. So we're going to take a quick little break. When we come back, we'll introduce our three guests that we have with us tonight. And again, we are live right in Charleston, from the Charleston, the historic Charleston Foundation. So we'll be back in just a moment.
GUPA, the bridge that ties Africa and Europe to America. It is a way of life in the Sea Islands of the Lowcountry of South Carolina and Georgia. It's a blending of West African, European, and Native American cultures that survived the transatlantic slave trade in America. Some 300 years later, stands as a witness for a great people who survived the horrors of the Middle Passage voyage across the mighty Atlantic and slavery of the African in America. A legacy that perseverance survived and triumphed. It is kept alive through foot stomping, hand clapping, soul stirring plantation melodies, spirituals, vivid storytelling by an elder in the native Gullah tongue, the artistry of a craftsman of sweet grass baskets, quilt making, and let us not forget through the sense of taste, delectable, palate pleasing low country Gullah cuisine, gumbo, red rice, sweet tater pie, stewed shrimp and grits. And these songs and stories are precious remnants of our ancestors' contributions to the Americas, the world. These spirituals and plantation melodies are sung in the natural style and tongue of the Gullah experience. It is meant to take the listener on a journey back into time. They represent a new birth of songs with techniques and words borrowed from our past. These songs are not rehearsed, but improvised according to the spirit, the feelings of the singer. This is a musical experience for the listener. It is a wonderful blessing for God to have allowed us to be the keepers of the culture. These songs are amazing when you, the listener, allow them to transcend you back into time and to transcend distance to the land of the gods. The beautiful, beautiful Seattle's of South Carolina.
After God heard that the ox was too a valley calling, the animal a two by two a valley ox, the camel and the kangaroo a valley calling, the bird got a note from a high shot, the moon and the star got a note from the sky, well, he stood on the land and he stood on the shore crying, oh, this time gonna be no more, but no, say, please, darling, no. Saint, please, Lord, don't leave me alone. Saint, please, Lord, don't
leave me alone. Guide me on my way.
Well, see, he went for the days and he went for the night. There wasn't no land, no way in sight. The north sand, mother raven, he sent him out of dove. The water, great God, will keep coming from above. But God showed Nora the rainbow sign, saying it wouldn't be water, but fire next time. And Lord said, please,
Lord, don't leave me.
Then please, Lord,
don't leave me.
Then please, Lord.
Well, tonight we are broadcasting live from Charleston, South Carolina, right here at the historic Charleston Foundation. And we have three guests with us right here at the foundation. They all are part of it. And I'm going to let them, I'm going to butcher right off the bat. So.
Everybody does.
All right. So I'll let you say what.
Okay. Fanyo.
Fanyo. Mm-hmm. Fanyo King. We have Brandy.
Culp.
And Lee.
Handle.
And I'm going to get them to shift around just a little bit because we're not picking up as good as we need to. So let's get this mic kind of in the middle of you two. And y'all can share that one. And me and Lee will share this one. And so, Fanyo, we'll start with you, and you can introduce yourself and what you do here with the Historic Foundation.
Okay. I am the manager of volunteer and public relations. So I work in the communications department and just try to let everybody know about all of our great programs and all the wonderful things we do here. And I work very closely with Lee.
So that would make sense. The one with the hardest name to pronounce is the one behind the communications.
Exactly. So, right. Everybody remembers me.
All right, Brandy.
And I'm Brandy Culp, and I'm curator here at Historic Charleston Foundation. So I care for and interpret the art collection at Historic Charleston Foundation. We operate two museum houses, and we'll talk more about that in a moment, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That'll be neat. Okay. And Leland, everybody tell or let everybody. And so this is the warmth in here that's getting to me. But now tell everybody about yourself, and if we'll get you to come up a little bit to the mics.
Sure, Jeremiah. Thank you. I'm Lee Handel, and I'm the Director of Communications and Public Programs here at Historic Charleston Foundation. As such, I work on all of our communications with our various constituencies. And I think perhaps the way people know me most is as the Director of the Festival of Houses and Gardens. That's been an annual program now going into its 64th year.
Wow.
Yeah, I can't take credit for all 64. But the last 13, anyway,
right.
With Fanyo. And the Charleston International Antique Show, which is also held here in Charleston in the spring. And both of those events draw, about 14,000 for the festival and another 3,000 for the antique show. So.
Well, we may have to just come back down for that one.
We'd love to have you.
Which antiques is, I love antiques. And, you know, that's something that, you know, if you ride through Charleston, you see a lot of antique shops. Do you tend to see that from your own experiences in older cities? I mean, just seems to be a lot of antiques, kind of a basis. Because like Maggie Valley, Waynesville, where I'm from, we don't have a lot of those.
We do in Charleston, and I bet Brandy can kind of expound on how that culture came to be. Charleston, of course, was first and foremost a seaport throughout its history. And so we receive shipments from all over the world, from China and Europe and the West Indies and everywhere in between. And as such, Charleston was always a very cosmopolitan city. Mm. And so we were a blending in many ways of a bunch of different cultures.
All right. Wow. Well, yeah, can you just a little bit more on that? And if I could just a little bit up.
Sure, absolutely, I can expand on that. As Lee mentioned, Charleston was rich in material goods. We were, in fact, the wealthiest city in the colony. And as such, as ships were traveling back and forth from Charleston to Asia and Europe and also the coastwise trade here in the Americas, lots of goods were coming and going. And there was a lot of money here, and people were known for having very lavish lifestyles, lavish goods. And it's wonderful to be able to interpret that culture today. And I believe that the antique shops here are an outgrowth of the love of the arts, but also the rich material that remains in the city.
Mm. And you know, kind of, you know, on lines of the arts, I mean, you can really see it through the city. I mean, we're just, I mean, Rainbow Row is just right down the road. And, I mean, it's a beautiful road just to drive down and see. And then some of the architecture on some of the buildings down through this side that we can see out the window are just beautiful. And I'd hate to see what the prices are for some of those, but
many are right about that.
Yeah.
I think our most expensive right now is what, 23 million, y'all?
Oh my goodness!
It's up,
over on LaGree Street.
Now, is it a big house, or is it mm-hmm. just because of like location and architecture and the history behind it?
All of the above.
Yeah. All the bells and whistles for the perfect historic property.
Mm-hmm. 23 million,
and very nicely restored.
I can't even get a $50,000 home. Much less $23 million. That's way off. This show better go a long way.
Well, I'll have to note, in talking about antiques, that a lot of folks who, like yourself, enjoy antiques will want to know that in the spring, the city puts on what we call Antiques Week in Charleston. And there are four signature events that make up that week. And they're all fun. And when you're not paying attention, we slip in some education. But they include not only the Charleston International Antique Show that features 32 of the nation's leading dealers in goods from 17th to early 20th century. And you might think that's just furniture, because that's what you think of first, I think, when you hear antiques. But it includes the most interesting things, including estate jewelry, things like couture purses. I love those. We have someone who works in that. Fine art, textiles, fabrics, quilts.
Wow.
What other exciting things? Majolica.
Ooh, beautiful rugs.
Oh,
Peter Pat.
Great rugs, that's right. Mm-hmm. In addition to the Charleston International Antique Show, that week also includes the Festival of Houses and Gardens, where you have a chance to go inside of these private residences. Now, folks like you and Dylan visiting this week, y'all have walked along the streets mm-hmm. and enjoyed how beautiful the properties are. But during that month-long festival, it's 30 days where we have the chance to go in and see the interiors and the private gardens of these magnificent private residences.
Wow.
It's a very rare opportunity to look beyond the thresholds and the garden gates. And then the Art and Antiques Forum is another event that goes on that week, and it's a very educational program. Brandy's been one of their featured speakers before for folks who want to learn more about the art and antiques. And then the fourth program in that week is the Charleston Symphony Designer House, which is where some designers will come into a historic property, and each designer takes a room and does beautiful things with it. And so it's just a fabulous week. This year will be March 17 through 20, and we'd love to have folks come and learn more about antiques and decorative arts.
Now, I've noticed, because I have visited Charleston off and on throughout the years. I mean, my brother lives down here. And it seems like there's always some kind of festival going on. You know, something to go on. And then did you mention one of them was 30 days?
Yes. Fanya and I work every day for 30 days. but we do. Charleston now is a year-round sort of destination, and our season sort of opens in February, I would say. Wouldn't you agree, Fanya?
With the
Southeastern Wildlife Exhibition. And that draws like 50,000 people.
Wow.
It's huge. And then you begin to go into March, and you come up with the Charleston Wine and Food Festival. That's a relatively new program, but very popular. The Cooper River Bridge Run, which I've run in, I'm glad to say. I have conquered the bridge. It hasn't been the last few years, but I've done it. Another humongous event. I think the largest run outside of Atlanta in the Southeast. And it, of course, goes over the historic Cooper River Bridge. The new historic Cooper River Bridge. And then, of course, we follow with Antiques Week and Antique Show and Festival. That's all in March and April. And then one of the city's main attractions in May and early June is Spoleto USA, a huge art festival. Mm. I'm sure Brandy can talk some more about that, too, along with our local companion to that, which is the Piccolo Spoleto Festival. It's the festival of two worlds, Spoleto, Italy, and Charleston, South Carolina.
Oh, wow.
And that's when I take my vacation. I'm a tourist in my own town. And then after that, we start going into the fall, and we celebrate the Mojo Festival, which celebrates our African-American culture and heritage here in the city. Great food, great entertainment, just a real celebration. And then later in the fall, our sort of sister organization in many ways, the Preservation Society of Charleston, sponsors the Fall House and Garden Tours. And so there's always something to do in Charleston.
Seems like Charleston seems to like to party a little bit.
and that's historically the case. Remember, it was a port city.
Right,
It is a port
city. Now, kind of a little bit back to the antiques for just a minute. Again, there's a lot of antique shops. Can you tend to find a lot of colonial antiques, things from colonial periods? Because, I mean, for me, I would find that more fascinating, you know, than almost anything, because, you know, we're looking at American history, you know, at that point. Can you find a lot of that stuff?
Well, let me back up 1 minute. That's my favorite period as well. it's a very interesting time, and Charleston is very much a colonial city. We talk about Walk the Wall, the parameters of the wall that existed here in the early 18th century all the way to the late 18th century. And portions of that you can find today, for instance, underneath this building.
I heard about that today. We will get into that later because that was fascinating.
So in terms of the material culture